Good morning.
Good morning.
Welcome. Good to have Joe Smith, isn't it?
Yes, sir.
With you today, with us today, and all of you.
Megan.
Where are we? Oh, Megan. Yes, Megan's in the back row there. I'm not saying she backslid or anything, but last time she sat closer to the front, though. But it's great to have her here. And so, if I can find where I'm supposed to plug in here. There we go. And what are you chuckling about now?
Oh, I was chanting you, cheering you on.
Plug. Oh, I see. Thank you. I need all the help I can get.
I can't do two things at once either.
Sure. There are certain activities that tend to exclude others. For me, I have a hard time doing math and carrying on a conversation at the same time. Math just takes more concentration for me.
I just had a hard time doing math.
Oh, okay. Very well. Anyway, I have a hard time doing Isaiah. This was another challenging chapter to work through, but it actually has some interesting things once you make it. So, Isaiah 24, and I will say that things are going to get brighter soon in Isaiah. But we have to wade through a little bit more here. And part of the challenge for me is that the format of Isaiah, you've got to remember that you're dealing with a literary form here, which is not fundamentally a logical development of ideas. So if you're used to studying Paul and that kind of layout, to go to the world of poetry and figurative language is just a tough change, and it's especially tough because it was written in a different language than you're reading it in, and poetry just doesn't translate that well, usually.
You could have written it in English.
If only. What was he thinking, right?
Modern English, preferably.
Yes. Anyway, Isaiah here in chapter 24 is continuing to look at a dark future for a human race that has forsaken God, that has moved away from the structure of life that God intended, and they're reaping a very dark harvest. And so he begins in this particular section. Behold, the Lord maketh the earth empty, and maketh it waste, and turneth it upside down, and scattereth abroad the inhabitants thereof. And so this is a picture which has happened over and over in the history of man. We're seeing it happen right now in the Ukraine. You look at the pictures of these cities that just a week and a half ago were full of people, were supplied with water and electricity and all the things that we just take for granted and food. And you look at some of them now, and they are piles of rubble. And so Isaiah, in looking at his world and the structure that existed then, it's hard for us to imagine the organization that we have, the civilization that we have, just being reduced to nothing, what it would be like. And yet, that's happened over and over again. And he notes here in these next verses that it's something which you can't escape based on your position in society. As it shall be with the people, so with the priest. As with the servant, so with his master. As with the maid, so with her mistress. As with the buyer, so with the seller. As with the lender, so with the borrower. As with the taker of usury, as in interest, so with the giver of usury to him. Covers the whole spectrum. The land shall be utterly emptied and utterly spoiled, for the Lord hath spoken this word. The earth mourneth and fadeth away. The world languisheth and fadeth away. And haughty people of the earth do languish. To make even more poignant, perhaps, on your mind, this radical change that occurs, got a few pictures here, which will save me some words, hopefully. So we look at a picture like this. This is a picture of the ruins of Caesarea. And I don't know what your response is. I mean, perhaps it's something of interest to you. Perhaps not. But compared to its former grandeur, it's a pile of junk. Right? You've got a little bit of structure left. See an arch in there. But all the glory and all the people are just gone. It's interesting to compare scenes. Here's a picture of a crowd of people everywhere. We have structures. We have perhaps some kind of celebration going on here. It's in China, so I don't know. But it's a picture of people. Here's a picture of the remains of a once great city in Palestine, Israel, the city of Lachish. It's now just a mound. At one time, it was a great and thriving city destroyed by the Assyrians. Here's a picture of New York. A lot going on there. But really no more going on than there have been in other cities and other times. Here's a picture of Nineveh. The capital of Sennacherib, one of the capitals of the Assyrians. It's hard to even make out anything substantial. What a change, right? Desolation. There's a picture of the towers before and the towers after. So I don't know what all Isaiah is seeing as he looks into the future, but there's this overwhelming sense of total destruction. All the things that we raise in pursuit of our various ends, whatever they might be, maybe as simple as housing, maybe as extravagant as some palace, they all come to naught. They all end up a pile of rubble. He says in verse 5, the earth also is defiled. The earth itself is defiled under the inhabitants thereof. Okay, and this, of course, speaks to that concept that was very much a part of the Old Testament understanding, that there's a sense of which the land itself has to be purified, and that it can be defiled by innocent blood, for instance. The earth is defiled of the inhabitants thereof, because they have transgressed the laws, they have changed the ordinance, they have broken the everlasting covenant. Okay, three things here that Isaiah lists as essential to expressing what it is that man has done to defile the earth. The first one, they've transgressed the laws. The Hebrew word here for laws is Torah. And it's more about instruction than it is about arbitrary command. So it speaks of a revolt against the instruction that God has given man. We come into this world really not having a clue about anything except one thing we have a good notion of. We know when we're happy, right? We know we want to be happy. We know we're going to complain if we aren't, one way or the other. And that's really about it. We don't know much. And God, for our benefit, has given us a structure for life, a structure based on which life can prosper under His hand. And He's done it through instruction, through teaching. And yet, every generation at some point reaches that point where they find that the instruction they have been receiving, whether it's valid or not, and it's not always valid, not everything you're taught's right, but we reach the point where we want to throw all that off. Let's reinvent ourselves. For the last couple of years, we've been trying to reinvent law enforcement in this country. Hasn't worked out that good, I don't think. But that sort of impulse to throw off the past, throw off the authority. Authority is a bad word for some people. Unless you're really in need and then you're looking for somebody that's got authority and authority in their field that can say the truth and it be actually true, something you can depend on. And of course, when you're talking about God, it seems that we should accord Him a certain amount of authority because He made everything. He does know a thing or two. And yet, in our impulse to discover ourselves and come to a realization of our potential, we tend to want to throw off authority. So He says this is one thing that has brought man to this place. They have rejected the teaching authority of God. Secondly, they have changed the ordinance. According to the commentator I've been referring to, he sees this as speaking of changing what was intended for the future. One of the words involved there speaks of engraving, something that is carved or engraved. And that suggests to him something which is preserved for the future. And so the key here is replacing what has been established for something else. And we see this over and over in human history, that every generation is trying to distinguish itself, trying to do something new. We have this incessant attempt to come up with a new philosophy, a new solution, a new paradigm by which to make the ultimate utopia, right? We're going to escape all the ignorance and superstition of the past and come up with something that brings us to our ultimate fulfillment.
It just strikes me that that's a little bit like, I want to be God, I want to create.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, I mean, and we do have that aspect, that image of the divine, I think. I don't think it's totally bad to want to create in some way. But when you change what has been established by authority, that's not creativity, right?
It's not putting myself under him.
That's true insurrection. If you want to talk about insurrection. Mm-hmm. It's a lunacy to imagine elevating yourself in your own mind to improve on what God has done. Come on. This makes no sense. He gives us room to create, room to work in our own space, but not to change what he has established. That's a different thing altogether. And so that leads us to be in a position of corrupting the earth, of defiling the very world that we live in. And then lastly, he says, they've broken the everlasting covenant. Now, there are several places in the Old Testament where this expression is used, the everlasting covenant. And we'll take a look at those right quick. It's not that it's obvious what Isaiah is referring to here, because it's referred to in different ways, and it may just be sort of a poetic expression of the relationship in general between God and man. But it is used, for instance, in Genesis chapter 9 in reference to the dealings there with Noah after the flood. So let's run there. Genesis chapter 9 and verse 16 or thereabouts. I'm going to start reading before that. In verse 12, and God said, "This is the token of the covenant which I make between me and you and every living creature that is with you for perpetual generations. I do set my bow in the cloud, and it shall be for a token of a covenant between me and the earth. And it shall come to pass, when I bring a cloud over the earth, that the bow shall be seen in the cloud. And I will remember my covenant, which is between me and you, and every living creature of all flesh. And the waters shall no more become a flood to destroy all flesh. And the bow shall be in the cloud, and I will look upon it, and I will remember the everlasting covenant between God and every living creature of all flesh that is upon the earth." Okay, so this uses that same language. This is not a covenant that man has opportunity to break, right? This is something God has said, I'm making this vow, this promise, this covenant with you. And so it's for our benefit in that we can remember the faithfulness of God in this regard, but it's not a covenant that we can break. Another use of this expression is in regard to Abraham. It's recorded in Psalms 105. And so let's run there right quickly. And so I'm going to start reading a little bit before. Verse 6, "O ye seed of Abraham, his servant, ye children of Jacob, his chosen, he is the Lord our God. His judgments are in all the earth. He hath remembered his covenant forever, the word which he commanded to 1,000 generations, which covenant he made with Abraham, and his oath unto Isaac, and confirmed the same unto Jacob for a law, and to Israel for an everlasting covenant, saying, I will give thee the land of Canaan, the lot of your inheritance, when they were but a few men in number, yea, very few, and strangers in it. Okay, so this is another use of the expression, everlasting covenant. And once again here, it's not really a conditional thing. This is something God will do. And there were later, of course, conditions involved where if they didn't follow in the footsteps of Abraham, they were at times dispossessed of this inheritance. But it is a covenant that God has instituted. This expression is also used with regard to the Sabbath within the Mosaic covenant. So in Leviticus 24, verse 8, we have a verse. Which says, every Sabbath he shall set it in order. And this is speaking of the loaves of bread in the tabernacle, 12 in number, shall set it in order before the Lord continually, being taken from the children of Israel by an everlasting covenant. The offering was taken from them. So just another use of that expression. And lastly, this expression is used with regard to the Davidic covenant and the future Messiah. So in 2 Samuel, we have an interesting passage. And I'm going to start from the beginning of this chapter. Now, these be the last words of David. David, the son of Jesse, said, "And the man who was raised up on high, the anointed of God, of Jacob, and the sweet psalmist of Israel, said, The Spirit of the Lord spake by me, and his word was in my tongue. The God of Israel said, The rock of Israel spake to me. He that ruleth over men must be just, ruling in the fear of God. And he shall be as the light of the morning when the sun riseth, even a morning without clouds, as the tender grass springing out of the earth by clear shining after rain." Okay, so even in his last words, David was a psalmist, right? Incredibly picturesque language. "Although my house be not so with God," and that's a awkward translation. We'll get another one in a moment. "Yet he hath made with me an everlasting covenant, ordered in all things and sure. For this is all my salvation and all my desire, although he make it not to grow." Okay, so verse 5 then. He's actually referring to the fact that his house is so with God. NAS says, "Truly is not my house so with the Lord? For he has made an everlasting covenant with me." Okay, so that's the sense of that, as you can pick up from the different translations there. The King James makes it a little more obscure. And then later in the book of Isaiah, this same expression is used to talk about the Messiah. It's used in messianic language. And so he says they have broken the everlasting covenant. And so even though in these other references that we see, it seems as though the covenant is mostly something God is doing. We realize from a wider view of Scripture that God's action in giving the land of Canaan to the descendants of Abraham, his action in establishing David's house as a perpetual kingship, they were conditional. And the conditions become obvious as time progresses. It is only in the ultimate end that David's house is an eternal kingdom. There were many years whenever, because of their falling away from God, there was not a son of David on the throne. And it is only as they follow in the way of the Lord that the descendants of Abraham possess the land. So Isaiah here points to a brokenness in this everlasting covenant. It's not that God's intentions have changed. It's everlasting in the sense that he is everlasting and his word never fails. But there are periods of time whenever things are not in a good way for those involved. Therefore hath the curse devoured the earth, and they that dwell therein are desolate. Therefore the inhabitants of the earth are burned, and few men left. And then he uses a number of verses here expressing metaphors associated with what was often associated with merrymaking. He says, the new wine mourneth of all things. The vine languisheth. All the merry-hearted do sigh. The mirth of tabrets ceaseth. So the music stops. The noise of them that rejoice endeth. The joy of the harp ceaseth. They shall not drink wine with a song. Strong drink shall be bitter to them that drink it. The city of confusion is broken down. Every house is shut up, that no man may come in. Okay, so now in this section, he goes back to describing with various metaphors the desolation that is evident in the kind of pictures that we looked at earlier. The city of confusion is an allusion to, in general, the human product of a city. What is a city? A city is sort of the embodiment of the greatest advancement of human achievement. A city is where all the things exist that men of flesh glory in. You take somebody that's used to city life and you put them in the country on a farm and they're like, wow, this is like primitive, right? They're just out of their element. And yet, when these great centers of human endeavor fall, they fall hard. Whenever they are without all the support systems that they normally have, they are a worthless place to inhabit. A horrible place. Some of the most basic necessities. You know, imagine a big city without a sewer system. Well, maybe not. but, yeah. So, the city of confusion is broken down. Every house is shut up that no man may come in. So, there's a security problem. There is crying for wine in the streets. There is no joy, and this is the way that people try to induce joy. All joy is darkened. The mirth of the land is gone. In the city is left desolation. The gate is smitten with destruction. Okay, so the gate symbolizes fundamental security of the city. If you don't have a gate, anybody can come in. Sound familiar? Yes. Walls work. And gates are important. And it's the picture here of a totally non-functioning city. It doesn't even have basic security. When thus it shall be in the midst of the land among the people, there shall be as the shaking of an olive tree and as the gleaning grapes when the vintage is done. Okay, so Isaiah here is coming back then from this dark, dark image and seeing something more positive. The harvest is over. There's not a lot left, but there is still some things. If you shake the tree hard, the olive tree, you're going to get a few olives. And there's a little bit of gleaning yet to be had. And if you've nothing else to eat, it'll be just fine. They shall lift up their voice. They shall sing for the majesty of the Lord. They shall cry aloud from the sea, so from the far places. Wherefore glorify ye the Lord in the fires, even the name of the Lord God of Israel in the isles of the sea. From the uttermost part of the earth we have heard songs, even glory to the righteous. Okay, so we have this little picture of light here, this positive note. And then it's almost like Isaiah has been so captivated by the images that he's seen of the negative and their impact on the individual that he's drawn back into this former picture as being a part of it, as recognizing his helplessness inside of it, this desolation. But I said, did I read the first part of 16 yet? From the uttermost parts of the earth we have heard songs, even glory to the righteous. But I said, my leanness, woe to me, my wasting away. The treacherous dealers have dealt treacherously. Yea, the treacherous dealers have dealt very treacherously. And this is a translation of a structure in Hebrew, which works very well, and which just seems woefully repetitive in English. but a part of the realm of poetry. Fear and the pit and the snare are upon thee, O inhabitant of the earth. And it shall come to pass that he who fleeth from the noise of the fear shall fall into the pit. And he that cometh up out of the midst of the pit shall be taken in the snare. Okay, you ever had days like that? Things just aren't happening. And every action you take to make things better, just dig your hole deeper, so to speak. I have days like that, way too many. There's all sorts of experiences in life which set you up for things like that. There are some processes in life, physical processes, which take special attention and are fraught with possible difficulty. One that I've recently been engaged in comes to mind. If you've ever worked with epoxy in serious quantities, you maybe can appreciate the fact that there are a lot of factors that go into this. You're on the clock, first of all. Once you mix it, you have a pot life, so to speak. And so if you don't use it before the pot life is over, everything in the pot is hard. And so then as you're applying it to a piece of wood, if the piece of wood has a crack or a hole in it, it just goes through and goes on the floor. And you don't like a lot of epoxy on your floor because it's really hard and hard to get up. And so then you're worried about that. And you've got gloves on which have epoxy on them, and you need to do something about the pot, and you got stuff on the floor and it's running everywhere, and yeah, one thing leads to another.
I thought it was difficult to make hot drinks fast.
Concrete is another job that's kind of that way. If you're pouring concrete where the you have deep forms like a basement or something, and they start giving away. That's not good. So I can relate to this image. You run from the fear and fall in the pit. You get out of the pit, you're caught by the snare. Oh, inhabitant of the earth. For the windows from on high are open, and the foundations of the earth do shake. Okay, so if you look at some of the images in this chapter, Isaiah has a number of resonances with the story of Noah that we referred to back early in the look at the everlasting covenant. And so this is one of them here. The windows on high are open, the foundations of the earth do shake. The earth is utterly broken down. The earth is clean dissolved. The earth is moved exceedingly. He is just so overtaken by the power of the vision. The earth shall reel to and fro like a drunkard, and shall be removed like a cottage. Okay, so perhaps he's seen the results of a whirlwind striking a cottage. And the transgression thereof shall be heavy upon it. It shall fall and not rise again. And it shall come to pass in that day that the Lord shall punish the host of the high ones that are on high, and the kings of the earth upon the earth. And they shall be gathered together as prisoners are gathered in the pit, and shall be shut up in the prison, and after many days shall they be visited. Okay, so the image is here in the world that he's a part of. A good part of the world worships the hosts of heaven, the stars and the planets. And of course, the other significant power in the earth are the kings. So he lumps these together, puts God over top of them in a position of punishing them. So if you're reading this as a contemporary of him, he's suggesting that everything in your mind that's powerful and important, God will bring into justice. Also then in verse 23, then the moon shall be confounded and the sun ashamed. And so what in the world is that about, right? The sun and moon were both worshipped. It's interesting that the last king of Babylon, the father of Belshazzar, who scholars call him Nabonidus, seems to have tried to change the religion of Babylon. Babylon was traditionally a staunch worshiper of Marduk, and Nabonidus tried to make the moon god. His name is spelled S-I-N, so it's kind of confusing to read because you're thinking of something else. But the moon god Sin to be the predominant god throughout the empire, and most of his inscriptions include the moon god, the sun god, and Ishtar on it. And so the moon shall be confounded, the sun ashamed, are direct statements into the world of religion of his day, that these things that you're worshiping don't hold a candle against the Lord of all, the Lord of hosts. When the Lord of hosts shall reign in Mount Zion and in Jerusalem and before his ancients gloriously. Okay. Chapter 24. Some strong imagery, not a lot of specific historical events that can be pointed to. It's not about a specific history that Isaiah is concerned with here. It is this general prediction of what shall befall man as a result of his departure, his changing of the order that God has established. And then, too, in it, a message of hope for the remnant who are still faithful, the remnant who still hold to a faith in God. And, you know, one thing that that I want to emphasize here is the difference that life has for the difference that there is fundamentally in life for those who look at whatever happens, whatever is occurring, and still hold on to a belief that ultimately God is in control, that ultimately there will be justice, there will be a time of judgment. We don't claim to know the details of how it's all going to work out. I can't tell you any specific conflict, how it will end. But there is something significant about resting in the peace that God will bring peace. He will bring an end. He will bring a finality to it. The option, of course, is for me to try to arrange things myself. I'm going to create a better world. And that's not to say we don't try to create a better world where we are, but in spite, regardless of him, independent of him, I recognize that my efforts might come at a bad time. They're not going to work outside of his plans. So I want to be faithful to be a witness to his justice and his righteousness, whatever age I live in. But I recognize that ultimately there is a higher good, there's a higher authority, there's a higher truth that I need to surrender to. And that creates a different kind of person fundamentally than somebody who is determined to build their own empire and their own reality, their own world. So Isaiah's message once again would be that there is a future of hope for those who maintain their faith in God.
Keith?
Yes.
23rd verse there.
Yes.
It's just a little confusing because it talks about, it seems like, well, it's talking about the Lord of hosts reigns, maybe it's the way. Okay. His glory will be before his elders is how, I think this is ESV. Anyway.
Okay, and so you remember back at Mount Sinai, whenever the glory of the Lord was shaking the mount, there was a group of elders along with Moses that ascended and had some interaction with God, and there was a limited vision of God given unto them. at that time. They couldn't handle the power of his glory in full. And so the image that Isaiah seems to be creating here is, so when Jehovah reigns in Mount Zion, all these other gods are going to be ashamed and confounded by comparison. You know, it's like you might think you're really dressed up and you walk into a really nice restaurant and you find out, oh, I'm not dressed up at all, right? That's what dressed up means. It's kind of that thing. His glory is so incredible that they're ashamed in comparison. The sun, okay? Sun's pretty bright. In comparison to the glory of God, the sun will be ashamed. And then, too, this picture of God revealing himself to his ancients, is how it's translated here, his elders, I think you said in your passage. So his faithful people.
Okay, it just... His ancients or his elders, it seems like.
Oh, you know, older than him?
Yeah. You know, older and over him. So, but it's not. That's.
Right.
That doesn't make sense.
They're his people, but they're not his elders. Elders. His elders are the people. There we are.
Yeah. Okay.
And of course, there's. You could spend tons of time looking at discussions of the language and different aspects of the wording, which you have to work hard to stay awake sometimes through all of it. But if it's something of interest to you, there's much more to be looked at here than we do in this read through. Anything else that you want to comment on there? Okay, well, we got 3 minutes left. This next chapter is a much brighter passage. I will read a verse or two of it. Since I don't have anything else come to mind to talk about. O Lord, thou art my God. I will exalt thee. I will praise thy name. For thou hast done wonderful things. Thy counsels of old are faithfulness and truth. Okay. Let's think for a minute about this. And this perspective was, I think, expressed in our songs this morning, our song service, praising God. Why is it so important for us to praise God? Have you ever thought about that? There's a lot of verses, especially in the Psalms, that talk about praising the Lord and... you hear that?
In my mind, I'm reminding myself of who he is and what he's like, and just expressing my trust in him and being grateful to him. A lot of things tied up in it.
To me, it sort of cements and reminds me of my position to him, relative to him.
Mm-hmm.
He's worthy to be praised because of who he is, but also I am who I am in relation to him. And prosecutor. He is, to me, just that, the submission, the...
So the emphasis is not so much on the action, so I did that, now it's done. But in the way that it creates relationship, right? It's, and it's not like that... I don't think we're saying that God likes to hear praises because it makes him feel good, and that's a good idea. But it puts us in the position, it reminds us, as you guys have said, of our position before him. Do we in fact realize who we are and who he is?
I know what you're saying about hearing praises, but do you think that it's accurate? In my mind, I think of him as like a father who wants... He knows that I trust him or that I don't. But just to communicate that, he takes joy in the fact that I am bringing myself before his presence and communicating with him. So that it's not... He's looking for empty words, but that he takes joy in my relationship to him. I trust him.
It wouldn't be a relationship otherwise.
Sorry. Right. And then two, there's a recognition that as human beings, we have something elevated in our mind. We have something that we are effectively praising, whether or not we say the words or not. Mm-hmm. So it is the admonition... in the Psalms and elsewhere to do this are an admonition to get it in your mind what is truly valuable, what is truly important. And not just a, come on, do it. No, say the words. No, it's not about that. It's about a recognition of reality that ends up changing you. It changes the way you look at life.
And isn't it true that we're taking delight in God as we do this sort of thing with the right mindset about it? We're going to seek delight somewhere. And so it's going to be a discipline at times to bring myself before him and think about him because I can't see him. I can't be in this physical kind of contact with him. But I love the concept of taking delight. What am I going to take delight in?
One slightly different angle on that too. Besides the fact that it's good for us, I would say praise rises like water flows downhill.
Okay.
So if we don't, the rocks will.
That's poetic.
Yes, that's poetic.
I think everyone who has that trusting relationship with him, when they are in his presence, I think the praise flows.
Yes. I've heard people use the passage you quoted there as more of a rote encouragement to just do it. Why aren't you doing it? So that's what I'm stumbling through there. That's the first verse of that chapter. There'll be more. We'll talk about that some more.
Thank you. Thank you.